I use TikTok occasionally. I'm not dancing on it. I've got a North Korean one that pops up in my feed occasionally. Tell me about how great it is, and do I want to move to North Korea? Yeah. And it has 160,000 followers. That's great. Do I want to move to North Korea? No, I don't, but it is quite comical. But that one is probably less subtle than some of the other political interference you may have, directly or indirectly. You know, whether it's trolling algorithms, I don't know whether that's happening, or whether it's just a content being generated, because we tend to believe, you know, what's in the media is real. You know,
yep.
So some of us will challenge and doubt it, others won't.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.
Hey folks, greetings and welcome along to the New Zealand Tech Podcast. I'm your host, Paul Spain. Great to be back again today with Philip Whitmore from KPMG Cyber. How are you, Philip?
I'm great. It's great to be back.
Yeah, it's been a little while, maybe pre-COVID that we last had you in. It was the old studios before we moved. So lots to talk about today. I'm keen to sort of delve into to sort of cyber and data privacy type, you know, topics. Obviously with a focus on New Zealand because it is the New Zealand Tech Podcast, but there's things going on in the broader world that are quite relevant as well. United States, China, TikTok. And there's some other news as well we can delve into on the AI front. Artificial intelligence seems to just be the thing at the moment, and some other local news to delve into. Before we start, of course, a big thank you to our show partners, to 1NZ, 2 Degrees, Spark, HP, and Guerrilla Technology. Well, for those who maybe aren't familiar with you, maybe just a little reminder where you fit into this big wide world of cyber and what your role is with KPMG Cyber.
Sure. So I'm a partner at KPMG, one of the large consulting firms. I'm in our cyber practice. So there's a few of us there, bigger and better every year. So we help organizations test security, design security, run security. So we help manage the risk from end to end.
Mm. And how big is your sort of cyber practice these days? Because you're not small in those regards, as far as New Zealand's concerned, shall we say?
No, but look, I'd have to add up the numbers, but I'm thinking we're 40 something, so we're not huge, but we're not small either.
Yeah.
We'd love to be bigger and better, but finding good staff can be challenging in New Zealand across many fields.
Yeah, definitely. Well, let's jump in. I see hitting the news is one of the things is that Callaghan Innovation, who are very closely connected with the tech world in New Zealand and you know work closely with a lot of the startups that that come through, and a lot of the high tech firms are going through sort of a cost cutting exercise. Do you think this is something that's unique to Callaghan? I mean, I think we've got a new government in play. They're looking to sort of rethink where money is being spent, probably across the board. So, I mean, this news that RNZ had covered is probably not unique to Callaghan, but I guess Callaghan will take their own approach in terms of how they look at cost cutting as a one of the smaller government entities.
Yeah, I look, that's common across the public sector. And certainly governments indicated that. I think most government agencies or many government agencies are being asked for savings of 6.5%, 7.5%. So no, it's nothing unique, but it is always hard. You know, I think we all know, the economy we live in has changed, and you've got a limited amount of resources. How do you use that better? It is an interesting challenge.
Yeah, 430 people. So I guess they have, over the 10 years that they've been operating as Callaghan Innovation, I think they have grown. And obviously, when they were founded, I think, what was it? There was some existing entities that sort of, came through into Callaghan. So I guess they're always going to have a number of people as long as they're around. And you never know with new governments coming into play when they decide to remix things, as it were, and slice government entities up and move things around and rebrand them and relabel them, as we've seen a bit of that happening, haven't we?
There's always some change. And look, Callaghan plays a critical role, and it's a fascinating organisation, critical role in helping develop innovation in New Zealand. So, I guess we watch and see where things are going.
Yeah, there was mention from RNZ of a scenario where this was maybe more broadly Callaghan Crown Research Institute and universities facing a loss of around $68 million annually in research funding when, you know, the current national science challenges end in the middle of the year. So there's a bit to sort of delve into on how these things will play out. And yeah, I think it can be pretty uncomfortable going through some of these changes. But we're also in a position where, you know, you can only spend so much money. So a challenging time ahead in those regards. Now we've seen a bit of coverage around the Fair Digital News bargaining bill, and you know, this has been, you know, quite an interesting one to follow. When I look at it, and I was asked on News Talk ZB around this, you know, what should the approach be doing? What should New Zealand do? And you know, one of the recent things is that there's some sort of levy put on international players. You know, there's probably multiple approaches that could be taken to how we ensure that the big players, the Facebooks and Googles and so on, that will draw on news content from our local media, but you know, today doesn't necessarily pay for that, and how that should be appropriately compensated. And I don't know, where I'm kind of landing is, well, look, New Zealand's a small country. We can't really dictate a whole lot on this basis. And if we, you know, put our foot down, you know, we're potentially going to lose our media getting coverage in those different platforms. And I guess I've always thought of it as being a sort of coverage for news media being in the big international platforms. If they're linking back to content of our media, then that's actually driving traffic to the media. So definitely a balancing act where I'm not sure that you can go too over the top. And, you know, probably the approach should be to lean in and follow what's happening in other markets, or at least other markets where it's working. Because I think, you know, we have seen things where there's been scenarios threatened or actual scenarios where, news has stopped to be carried. I think it was Canada that had a scenario like that. Any thoughts on where you think we go?
I tend to think similar thoughts. Yeah, it is difficult. We are a small player, you know, but that news is something that the news organisations are producing. You know, you can have a degree of influence. Can you control it? Probably not. But I can also understand that media companies, you know, how we consume news is different these days. So your more traditional media organisations, their funding is dropping, and it's also information they produce. But I think it's not something we can do by ourselves. It more is what is us and other countries doing. But the likes of Google and others does drive, you know, traffic towards other sites as well. So I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, there's two parts to it, isn't there? Because sometimes they get all the benefit, other times people click through. But yeah, we do see it all the time in social media, where, you know, a headline or a link gets shared, and then all the commentary will be based on the five words that were in the, you know, or eight words or whatever it is that were in the headline, without actually ever clicking through, reading the content and consuming it. It's what was basically in that preview, and that generates masses of traffic for a social media platform. Maybe keeps people on there as they're discussing and debating it. And yeah, only a percentage of the people are clicking through, and you know, I'm sure there's a level of that happens on Google, as well as this happens on social media platforms. So yeah, it is a complicated one. I'm certainly glad that it's not something I've got to try and figure out. Although I would have thought that there would be a kind of a mathematical or a scientific way to actually do some sort of evaluation on this stuff and land on a methodology for what is a fair and appropriate way to to do it. But yeah, I guess we don't necessarily have to do that if other countries are putting in all the work and effort. We don't have to spend millions of our dollars researching and trying to land on the perfect solution. We can emulate what the best one is out there.
And I think, you know, that I imagine will be coming, and I imagine all parties would be, you know, happy to deal with that. At the moment, it's a bit of an unknown. You know, what is the fair thing to do? There's no easy answer.
Mm. And the challenge is we're now in a situation where our media are, you know, effectively being disrupted. Right. So, you know, we've heard, you know, News Hub, most indications suggest that they are going to close down and, you know, unless something new comes up, TVNZ, shutting down some of their most successful and long running content in terms of, Sunday and Fair Go, which, yeah, looking at the, you know, the viewerships and so on, it's a little bit hard to get your head around. That they would take that approach, but yeah, clearly that's what they are thinking is their way to cutting back and to saving some money. You've got a feel for those people that have, you know, they've gone through, they've spent years studying. This is their career path, and then the rug's being pulled out from under them. Even though, you know, I think probably all of us have known for, I don't know, decades that we should expect in our lifetimes to change, you know, careers kind of multiple times, and that would happen. But having it sort of foisted upon you en masse, because a lot of people deal with this, you know, as individuals without the media coverage around it, but it happening to a whole lot of people en masse, I mean, it's a horrible thing to sort of see it happening, and especially when you know a bunch of the people that are being impacted. I think, you know, the positive side is that most of the people, certainly the ones I've got to know, you know, in varying roles across, you know, the likes of News Hub and TVNZ and other media, seem to be great, hardworking, you know, people. Who will, you know, end up doing great work in something maybe, you know, slightly different, but I can't see them, you know, not being able to land on their feet. But it's a pretty hard period in between.
I think you're right. You know, it's going to have a significant impact on the individuals and their families. But I can also understand that a business, you know, isn't there to lose money. In fact, it can't work losing money. So it's tough. And I think we saw similar things back in 2020 as we entered sort of COVID and lockdowns. A lot of, you know, restructuring happened then for some organisations. But I think most of those people, you know, landed on their feet doing something different, albeit, you know, there's a period of pain in between.
It's tough. And when it's not happening to, you know, to you, it definitely, you know, you will see it through a different lens than when it is happening to you and you kind of see those realities. So, you know, definitely, you know, try and have empathy, but I know that I can't understand exactly what it's like when I'm not actually in that in that position myself. Now, one thing that we have talked over the years about is, you know, a lot around disruption and digital disruption, and it, you know, and it's always part of my discussion actually when I'm, you know, wearing my futurist hat and doing a conference keynote and encouraging sort of futurist mindset and this, you know, approach that we all need to be thinking ahead. We all need to be futurists and preparing for coming changes, because technology will, continue to disrupt. And I look back at, you know, my earliest days in the workforce, and I, you know, started out with a magazine publisher, and I'll often talk through, where are these magazine publishers now? Where are the printing firms? You know, so many of those firms that were, you know, just mainstays in those days are either completely gone, or, you know, they've gone through incredible change in order to stay relevant. You look at the ad agencies, for instance, you know, that part of what they've had to do is kind of, you know, acquire the young digital upstarts that are coming through in order for these big old firms to stay relevant. But of course, in some cases, like what we're seeing here in the news media, you know, the outcomes aren't that rosy No, I mean, potentially.
Technology does disrupt us. It often doesn't feel quick. And maybe it's not quick, but it still causes an interruption. Mm. You know, I'm just going to the video store on a Friday night to grab a video. You know, my local video store probably closed down 3 years ago, but you know, there's only a handful left around the country. You know, I miss, as a teenager, going and, you know, to the music shop, look at some records or some DVDs.
Yeah.
Yeah, you still get those. And there is, you know, you can probably get more on vinyl now than you can, you know, 5, 10 years ago. But changing. But change is, you know, sometimes good and different. And I think, you know, we benefit collectively on the positive outcomes. But the impact on individuals and businesses, you know, in the shorter term is not great.
Mm, mm. And yeah, that's part of, I mean, you know, you could talk of New Zealand Tech Podcast as part of the problem for mainstream media, right? We are a smaller media outlet, and you know, when a small media outlet operates, usually operates with a lot less resources than the traditional media. So that's part of the disruption, the fact that we can, you know, live stream video and put an audio show out. 20, 30 years ago, this sort of stuff was completely impossible. And it is part of the changing shape of this world. And I think it will continue to change. And I, you know, just hope we get good outcomes, you know, over time, and that, you know, these things land in a good manner. But we do have those challenges, you know, of being a smaller market as well, right, which is going to play into it. And so, you know, Kiwis will probably, you know, continue to lean in on some of the big international sort of media outlets. And, yeah, it's even hard to get your head around that in terms of, you know, in the old days with Sky and you'd stream your CNN news and so on. Now there's umpteen different news platforms that are streaming, and a lot of them you can get for, you know, completely free. And that might come with some strings attached if it's, you know, RT, Russia Today, or, you know, whatnot. You know, one's coming from different parts of the world and with different sort of, you know, political perspectives sort of tied into the content.
I think we can expect technology disruption forever. We've been talking about it since Victorian times.
Yeah.
I mean, the first cyber attack, what we might call cyber attack, happened when the weaving loom got introduced to modernise making of fabrics. So they were going back a long time ago. But that doesn't make it any easier on the people that it impacts. But it is a constant change ahead. You know, if we could all predict the future and be, you know, dynamic enough to change with that, it'd be fantastic. I think we'd all be millionaires.
Yeah.
But it's tough. Yeah. It really is.
Yeah. Little bit of news in on one of our show partners on 2Degrees, a bit of a change up of their execs. So they have a new chief technology officer, Stephen Kujaya. He has stepped into the CTO, the chief technology officer role, with Martin Sharrock resigning. So, so a bit of a change there. And also Adrian Dick has moved across to be the chief transformation officer. So some interesting shuffles going on there, as we tend to sort of see across the sector from time to time. But these are really key roles for 2Degrees. And, of course, 2Degrees is a bigger and, you know, more important, you know, player within the telecommunications sector, you know, now than where they were sort of five or ten years ago. Certainly when we started this show, you know, they're a very, very small player. And so it's been fascinating to watch that. So we'll be certainly tapping in with them on an upcoming episode and hearing a little bit more of what's going on behind the scenes, as we tend to do across each of the telcos who are, you know, each, I guess, innovating in their own different directions and, you know, continuing to sort of establish their future and deal with the ongoing disruptions themselves, right? And we see it's quite interesting in the different, you know, steps that they've each made to compete in different ways and in different sectors well beyond the traditional telecommunications space, right?
It's a fascinating sector, and I think it is interesting. They tend to be more innovative than a lot of technologies companies see in New Zealand.
Yeah.
You know, I'm sure competition helps out a bit. As consumers, we all tend to benefit from it. So always interested to see what all the telcos are bringing out and, you know, how we might benefit.
Yep. And you know, we do tend to call them out on the odd mistake as well on the show. But we appreciate their support, which is brilliant. Now onto other items. I guess if we're looking at the bigger picture, what's happening, you know, around the world, the big thing that I've been called on the last few days to talk about across RNZ and News Talk ZMB has been this move to really crack down on TikTok. This seems to be a really, really big deal. And of course, Trump tried to do this and wasn't successful. But it looks like the lawmakers on both sides of the House in the US are keen to push ahead with new legislation that would basically force ByteDance, who own TikTok, to either divest of TikTok or shut it, you know, exit the US market, which is just, you know, it's quite fascinating. Last week when I was asked about this, and you know, what do you think the chances that this will go ahead after having sort of seen things fail in the past? My take was maybe 50-50. But the things that I've been reading and monitoring on it suggest this is a pretty sort of serious thing this time around, and so I'm starting to lean more and more in the direction that this will pass, that it in theory anyway, they've done their due diligence on what's going to get through the media. A lot of the pushbacks last time were around free speech, and that this would impact that, but by very clearly offering for the ownership to change, that impacts the picture. The two areas that we're seeing where the issues are being raised is one around sort of spying and on the user base in varying ways, and we've already seen, you know, US government, New Zealand parliamentary devices are in the same category where TikTok is not allowed on the devices, for those, or presumably for those reasons of spying. But then the other bit, which I tend to think, you know, particularly being an election year in the US is even bigger, is the aspect of algorithms and, you know, what happens if you've got a government who, has so much power over any company that operates in that country, and maybe not in a transparent way, who might like to ensure that the algorithms show particular types of content? You know, how could that play out? That could change the results of an election. So I think it's those two aspects that are really big. I think, you know, varying people have their own challenges and thoughts. What are your thoughts? Because social media companies in general, you know, I can't say they're a particularly liked or trusted bunch. And almost regardless of what perspectives you come from a political standpoint, you can find a company that will offend you, right?
Yeah, look, it is interesting. Having watched it and being a TikTok user myself, I think a big part of it potentially in the US is political grandstanding. We all saw the videos where the senators are interrogating the chief executive, a Singaporean gentleman, yes, about, you know, was he Chinese? Was he a member of the Chinese Communist Party? You know, it came across like, well, they don't understand the difference. I think the senator clearly understands the difference between Singapore and China, but, you know, he's playing out to people in the US, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
So that's part of it. But, you know, social media companies as a whole, they do collect a lot of information about us. So I think it comes down to, you know, where you're from and which side of the political debate you're on. You know, if you've got someone like Meta, they are privately owned. You know, US doesn't have much influence, if any influence, on them. If you're Chinese owned, you know, there has to be a level of influence from government in China, just how it's structured, the more socialist nature of them.
Yeah.
So do you trust one and not trust the other? Do you not trust either of them? Trust them both? It's not easy. So it is what stance. And, you know, I can understand the concerns they raise about, you know, ByteDance ownership of TikTok. TikTok was already looking to move all their data for certain US citizens into US. I think it was called Project Texas or name similar to that. That wasn't good enough. Certainly people's perception. So I can imagine it's going to happen, which is a challenge. And, you know, it is very much about freedom of the press, freedom of speech. If that gets cut off, do people just work away, circumvent around it? Because you won't be able to download the apps in the app stores. That doesn't mean you can cut download from an app store in a different country while being in the US. So will people circumvent it? Particularly as Android, you can download for any app store you like.
Yeah.
And we're already starting to see with the Apple, we're in the EU now, you can download, you know, apps from different app stores as well. So will what the US does have an influence? You know, they can ban app stores for having it. Can they ban individuals from using it?
Yeah, well, I think that's part of what New Zealanders will be curious about, because we've got, and I haven't got the numbers in front of me, but, you know, last I looked, you know, a big base of users in New Zealand, you know, I think certainly the high hundreds of thousands, if I recall correctly, based on previous stats. So there's a big user base here, right? And so yeah, what would happen if the US banned it? And this is where I think, well, the banning to me seems less likely than actually ByteDance divesting of it. But then how long does that take for them to divest of it? These things often can take, you know, they're saying there's a 6-month window on this, right? And if we step back through the sort of big acquisitions that you know we've seen over the last decade, it's unusual for any of those to actually clear within a 6-month period. So they might announce one, but for it actually to take effect, you know, these things can take multiple years to go through. So yeah, there's certainly some complexity as to, you know, how those sorts of things would play out. And then yeah, if they were at all banned in the US, I would think actually we would be fine in New Zealand and it would keep running. However, a lot of the content comes out of the US. So then what does that do to TikTok as a platform if some of the biggest content creators are, you know, no longer able to operate, or do they, as you say, sort of, you know, manage to still get their content up to TikTok, even if maybe the broad populace ends up losing access within the US? So there's a few ways it could play out, isn't there?
It's interesting. And look, I can understand the concerns, you know, but, you know, the same content as shows across Reels and Instagram and other platforms as well. Will people move platforms? I don't know. But, you know, it is the collection of data. It is political influence. You know, influence on other countries certainly does happen through social media and other mechanisms as well. Mm. I mean, I've got to laugh. I've got, I use TikTok occasionally. I'm not dancing on it. I've got a North Korean one that pops up in my feed occasionally. Tell me about how great it is, and do I want to move to North Korea? Yeah. And it has 160,000 followers. That's great. Do I want to move to North Korea? No, I don't, but it is quite comical. But that one is probably less subtle than some of the other political interference you may have, directly or indirectly. You know, whether it's controlling algorithms, I don't know whether that's happening, or whether it's just the content being generated, because we tend to believe, you know, what's in the media is real. You know,
yep.
So some of us will challenge and doubt that, others won't. You know, if I look on TikTok also, I believe the earth is flat based upon the information that comes to me.
Yeah.
It's quite fascinating.
Yeah.
But it is an interesting challenge. And, you know, if it plays out in the US, will it play out in other countries beyond that?
Yeah.
You know, Europe is an interesting challenge, you know. We'll wait and see.
Yeah, I'm very curious as to you know what the future will hold for us on this front, and I guess we're just going to have to keep monitoring and seeing what actually does proceed within the US, and maybe we'll know fairly shortly. I mean, it's already had a level of approval, so it's just got to work its way you know through from there, and then the waiting game begins. Now, also sort of looking at the US, we've seen this media coverage come through in the last few days around a Microsoft engineer warning that his name's Shane Jones, actually, different from the Shane Jones in New Zealand. So he's worked in Microsoft for a little over half a decade. He's been testing, I guess, some of their sort of co-pilot designer type features, so particularly focused on the images. And he's saying that Microsoft's tools, which are effectively the tools from OpenAI, because they just license those tools and that AI and provide their appropriate sort of front end and changes. He's warning sexual and violent content being able to be produced by the product at the moment. And this, seems to be an ongoing story that there are dramas and challenges when it comes to AI platforms, and there are mechanisms through which you can control the way these platforms operate, usually based on the words and whether you're willing to accept those or maybe filter them out before they're given to the AI system or the large language model to deal with. And I saw one the other day that somebody used. So their input was not to put the word in a normal sense, but they made ASCII art. So they used different characters together to write out a word. And so when it was being sort of parsed before it got into the AI system, it didn't see the issue. But once the AI got it, it's like, hold on, you're trying to say this. And then, and then it was able to do it. So it got past, whatever filtering mechanism was there at the front. And then as we saw with what Google and Alphabet did and attracted so much attention for, then you've got the different sort of knobs that have been turned and little kind of hard-coded things to try and encourage the AI to output in a particular direction. And the results of those may vary. So, I mean, this one is reasonably, shocking with some of the things that they're saying that anyone can get out of the Copilot, especially where the app is marked as child friendly and so on. If you've got an app that actually can, maybe come up with some reasonably inappropriate content.
I find it an interesting debate, because a tool can be good or bad. I've got a screwdriver. I can use that screwdriver to help, screw in part of my deck and fix my deck. That's a positive. I can use that screwdriver to jimmy the lock on your Mazda Demio and do a RAM raid. So is that a good tool or a bad tool?
Oh, that sounds like an evil tool that it could be used that
click,
way.
Click. I might steer your car with a screwdriver. And I think it comes down to other tools like AI. It is a bit of an arms race. Mm. That the companies developing these tools want to do good, and it does help to have society debate what is good and what is bad.
Yeah.
Albeit, what might be good from my perspective might be different from your perspective.
Yep.
So they do put things in place. I can't use, Copilot. I can't use Copilot, say, write a phishing email to try and trick people to give me stuff. And we do phishing as part of our job. We phishing test for organizations. Yeah, okay, so won't do that. That's a good thing. Mm. I could ask it, just write me an email to ask someone for their password, and it would. But it can't tell good or bad. They're trying to filter block. But humans are an imaginative bunch. That's why it is a bit of an arms race.
So true.
Originally, certainly when ChatGPT came out from OpenAI, a great tool for developing code. Help write some code to do this in this language.
Yeah.
Great.
Yeah.
Help write some code that will exploit this vulnerability. Oh, that's bad code. But what is good? What is bad?
Yeah.
Who says this is right and this is wrong? Who makes those judgment calls? For some things, it's easy.
Mm.
Don't show you know, this type of pornographic image, or maybe don't show pornographic images at all. That's easy for us as a society to say good and bad. Other things, it comes down to our individual perceptions, whether it's good or bad.
Yeah.
And again, I will put something to stop that because we all think it's bad, but someone else will use their imagination to get around it. It's always been that case with tools and IT tools. But it is challenging, and it becomes more challenging with the likes of video and images and sound, whereas, okay, that, you know, that's a cartoon, that's not real. That's not a cartoon, but I can't tell whether that's real or not. That blurring between reality and non-reality is challenging. And while, again, there's a range of discussions about how do we do it, we put a little star on the image to say it's fake. I just, you know, Photoshop that star out. I don't think there's an easy answer when it comes down to morals and ethics, but I think that the technology companies are trying and continuing to evolve, and other people are trying to evolve to get around those blocks.
Yep. I saw a very interesting one around AI training, and by this I'm not talking about training the AI. I'm training the users in their prompt engineering to understand, you know, the varying aspects of using AI. You know, this is you know, one of the things we produce here in the studio is a lot of our course material for Guerrilla Technology. Sometimes it's delivering a remote keynote or a talk and so on. And so anyway, for one of these things, basically content around Microsoft Copilot for Microsoft 365. Just trying to work out, well, you know, what's a really good description? Let's see what Copilot can produce for us in terms of a description. You know, we asked it to provide a good description for the training, and what came back was very Microsoft promotional element to it. And it was like, no, this is just a description of the content. What we're not after you to wave the flag and to highlight how Microsoft, you know, Copilot for 365 keeps your data private and this and that. It's not about you, Microsoft. This is about this content.
It sounds like you might need some more prompt engineering skills.
Well, the thing was, whatever we tried, it would come back with something like this. So I've actually just tried it again. It's come back with a whole lot of stuff. And I'll read out what it's put. By the end of this module, participants will gain insights into Copilot's capabilities and Microsoft's dedication to responsible AI practices. And everything that we asked to say, oh, please remove the little bit about Microsoft's dedication to AI practices. So you ask it to rewrite it with that bit removed, right? And, yeah, basically, you could not get it to do it. And eventually what it did, like grayed out the box, I couldn't put any more in. It was just like, no, I refuse to obey your commands to try and, you know, steer me in this direction. And this was after it was telling me that I was trying to be evil and trying to, you know, get it to say negative stuff. And I was just like, no, I'm not trying to get you to just say negative stuff. It's just, this is not your place for promoting yourself, Microsoft AI. And yeah, just quite hilarious to see how it actually dealt with that. And I guess this is where some of these hard coding type things come through. So yeah, it's gonna be interesting to see how they evolve.
Yeah, I don't think Big Brother's out to get you, so I think it's okay. It's interesting because I tend to think as a technologist, I tend to think technology evolves quite slowly. My cell phone, my mobile phone that I use now, is almost the same as the one I used 10, 12 years ago. Better camera, you know, better resolution, but essentially the same.
Yeah.
From us talking originally about the concept and idea of large language models to having something that's commercially in our hands that we can use now to do lots of great things, whether it be Copilot or some of the other products, that's been a very, very short time frame. You know, I want to say 6-9 months, you know, from idea to something in our hands.
Yep.
So that is interesting. You know, people should play with it. You know, get Copilot. There are free versions of Copilot. There are free versions that sort of work in the enterprise versions.
That's important, isn't it, from a data privacy perspective, that people are, you know, are using a product that is appropriate for, you know, for use within an organization where you've got confidential data. You shouldn't just sort of drop it into random AI tools and especially, you know, free bits and pieces. Your mileage may vary.
It is. I mean, there are enterprise versions for enterprise purposes, free versions for free purposes. And I think, you know, most of the organizations, most of the, you know, ones that are well known, your Microsoft's, like, clearly explain the differences and what they do and what they don't do, you know. And there are ways to manage risk as well. So, you know, we're a very risk-averse organization, yet we're using essentially a version of ChatGPT internally. So it's in our Azure environment. It stays there. It's not the public version.
Yeah, safe and secure.
And we're using that as a great tool to help drive business. But we have control over everything.
Yeah.
But also free versions, and we might put free some information in there, but not others.
Yeah.
It is, again, a tool.
Yeah.
But it is a tool to get the imagination going about how it might benefit ourselves, our businesses, you know, our clients, whoever it may be.
That's good. Now, looking sort of, you know, away from the you know, broader news that's that we've been, you know, headlines we've been reading and discussing those things, looking closer to home, and, you know, particularly the sort of things that you've been seeing out there in terms of trends and things going on in New Zealand, you know, from a cybersecurity and data privacy perspective. What are the things that are standing out for you that are on the horizon in terms of, you know, changes coming for us in New Zealand, and the, you know, the trends and you know, common cyber dramas that you've been seeing out there?
Sure. Look, it's interesting in the cybersecurity world, because in New Zealand particularly, I don't think we're getting better. We probably have the lowest maturity, so therefore probably the, you know, lowest effectiveness of the developed countries that are similar to us.
Mm.
Yeah, it's a mixture of a lack of regulation. It is our "she'll be right" attitude, or, you know, hakuna matata to an international audience. It isn't good. We've talked about it more than we ever have. We're spending more money on it than we ever have. Are we getting better? I don't think we are. You know, we're sometimes keeping pace with the evolving threat, sometimes we're not. So it is interesting. But there is hope. And this is going to sound quite wrong, because there is a bit of a stick coming. Albeit it's not really a stick. So we have no regulation in New Zealand around cybersecurity. We have a Privacy Act that says you must keep private information secure, and that's great. But beyond that, there's nothing. There is regulation just over the horizon that's coming that way. So if you're a financial services organisation, certainly the likes of the Financial Markets Authority and the Reserve Bank of New Zealand have put out guidelines in recent years about cybersecurity and their expectations. I imagine those will change into a form of regulation. Normally, you know, when regulation appears, it hits financial services the most, because that stuff impacts you and I.
Mm.
And we've already seen government communicate expectations to banks this week about trying to combat fraud, you know, scams, where I say, "Hey, I'm Philip. Here's my bank account. Just pay me. Don't worry, be safe." But there isn't matching of my bank account to my name. And that's been the same around the world. It's nothing unique to New Zealand. Other countries have started to evolve some, and the expectations have been clearly made here. You know, and that could take out a significant amount of the scams and frauds that impact you and I as individuals, and particularly small businesses. So it's been regulation financial services. Also, you know, which is very close by, is regulation around critical infrastructure. So most developed countries have legislation, regulation about protecting that as critical to New Zealand, critical infrastructure. Now, it used to be about energy generation, electricity, water supply, but it's evolved. But we don't have any of that, not even around the basics yet.
Mm.
I look at Australia, it's, you know, more than a year ago now, they took their act around critical infrastructure and expanded it to be around food production, education, all those things that are critical to Australia as a nation, domestically and internationally. So New Zealand, we've been talking about this. I don't think COVID probably helped the quickness of it. I don't think a change of government probably helped too much as well, but it's coming very soon. And I imagine it will look like the Australian model, where if you're an organisation that's of critical importance to New Zealand, to New Zealand Inc., there will be some level of expectations of what you must do. Now, that's not going to be a high hurdle. It's going to be aspects of good practice, but that will help. So that's a bit of a stick. We don't tend to do big sticks. It's more an encouragement, but that might help lift things up. You know, to go from where we are, pretty bad at cybersecurity, to being pretty good isn't a huge hurdle. But imagine if we were good at cybersecurity, we could be a Singapore-type nation. You know, we could export New Zealand's a safe, secure place to the world. You know, we're safe, secure, come live here. We're safe and secure from an IT perspective as well. And particularly the new data centers opening up with the likes of Microsoft bringing Azure here and Google Cloud and AWS. Why couldn't we be that Singapore of the South Pacific? And you know, countries already inherently trust us. Let's trust us from an IT perspective, but it needs our cybersecurity to rapidly increase.
Yeah, that's a good point. And when we look at, because we are a country that is full of the sort of smaller businesses a lot, and obviously, you know, medium and large as well, but with just so many small businesses, what are you seeing as this kind of New Zealand that's behind? Is that as predominant in small business from your perspective as it has been in years gone by?
I think it's just as bad. And the challenge with small business, often you don't have any IT staff or people focused, and no people focused on cybersecurity. And you rely heavily upon an IT or outsourced organization to support you. The problem is that the mileage will vary about what they know about cybersecurity and what they don't.
Yeah.
So sometimes you'll get no advice, really poor advice. Sometimes you get good advice. And I often get asked, who's someone good to use? And I often don't know an answer to that. I know lots of good individuals, and I know lots of organizations that are good at this and that. Mm. But from a cybersecurity perspective, who do you go use? I don't know. That you know, sometimes that is a challenge. Mm. But I do see good instances of it. I guess the good thing is, if you are a small business, where do you start?
I would say come and talk to me, but keep going.
Or us.
Exactly.
CertNZ, which was part of the Ministry of Business Innovation and Employment.
Mm.
It's now part of the Government Communications Security Bureau.
Yes.
Puts out some great advice for us as individuals, small businesses, medium and large as well.
Mm.
That is some good advice.
Great resources.
And maybe that's, if you're a small business owner or running a small business, pull out, say the critical controls, the 10 best things you could do to prevent a cyber attack, limit the impact should one occur, and to recover from it. Take out those 10 critical controls that are on the CertNZ website, all free, and say, Mr. IT provider, have we done all this?
Yeah.
Now, I expect the answer will be no. In fact, I've not seen a small business yet that has all 10 of them. And these are designed for all sizes of business.
Yeah.
That's probably your security strategy for the next year on that page. Yeah. Please help me.
Yeah. That's really good. That's really good advice. And going back to, those sort of lists, we've got the Essential 8 out of Australia and, varying ones around the world. Those are great reference points to focus on and very easy to put in front of, put in front of people as well. So we definitely need to be, need to be doing more of that. And I mean, I see it too, we're regularly out, auditing the technology and cybersecurity in, smaller to medium organizations. And sadly it doesn't seem to have sort of moved along at the sort of pace that you might have expected after, all of the dramas that we've kind of, had over the years with different firms getting hit in different ways. And look, some of this comes from, the small businesses themselves. I've been in talking to firms and they've had multiple, incidences and they, maybe haven't been that bad. So they're just like, well, this just seems to be par for the course of being a business. And we're not gonna change a whole lot. So, maybe an unwillingness to invest, and sometimes they've been taken out even in somewhat significant manners, and it's like, oh yeah, we were back up and running within a few days, they're looking for the very cheapest way possible, and of course the a challenging economy impacts us in these regards as well. And, you know, we've got government departments that are looking to cut back. We've got small businesses that are struggling. And so when it comes to, you actually might need to invest a bit more here and step up what you do from a cyber perspective, that's pretty hard when there's maybe a struggle to, you know, cover the existing costs and keep up with bills as it is, right?
It is a challenge. It is a challenge economically. It's a challenge because it's like mental health. We don't talk about it enough, you know.
Yeah.
I've not been affected. I don't know anyone else has been affected, therefore it won't happen to me. And that's not a scenario. You know, you've been affected, but you're not going to tell me because you feel embarrassed. So we see organisations, we see it in industry groups at times, sharing information about what's impacting them. Actually works a lot better to uplift everyone. Look, there are other resources as well. If you're a small business, there's a great New Zealand startup company called Onwardly that's developed resources for small to medium businesses to uplift their cybersecurity. You know, you don't need to have that IT person. You don't need to have that chief information security officer. For a relatively low amount of money, they've got a range of processes and things that they can guide you through and tools and techniques to help improve cybersecurity. You know, that Onwardly has appeared probably in the last year or so. That's great.
Yeah, and I think we've had Phil on the show maybe a year or so back, if I remember correctly. But
great product, very enthusiastic guy, fellas.
Yeah. It is important to double down on this stuff. So yeah, really, really good reminder. It's been great to catch up again and delve into these topics. It's always one of those things that. There's so much going on and everybody is so busy, you know, limited in resources. But, yeah, really it's the last thing that we should be, pushing down our to-do lists is improving our cybersecurity. So, really great to catch up, Phil.
Oh, excellent. Thanks for having me again.
Yeah. So for folks that are just wanting to maybe connect with what's happening at KPMG Cyber or connect with yourself, is it LinkedIn? What's the best way to track you down?
LinkedIn is great. Philip Whitmore, you'll find me there, or KPMG Cyber as well.
Yep.
Happy for people to reach out, say hello, have a bit of a conversation, not a problem.
Yep. Okay. That's awesome. Well, that's us. We're out of time for this episode, but thanks everyone for joining us on the New Zealand Tech Podcast. Of course, a big thank you to our show partners, Guerrilla Technology, HP, Spark, 2Degrees, and 1NZ. And you will find some of those partners do a fair bit also on a cyber perspective. So, you know, it's not as though, you know, folks are sort of limited for choice, is it, in terms of getting help from a cybersecurity perspective. But I always think it's a combination. Organizations, you know, need to, invest their own time as well as finding partners that can help them move forward from a cybersecurity perspective. So, that's us for this week. Thanks everyone for listening in. If you've been catching the video, then we would always encourage you to make sure you subscribe to the audio podcast. So be that through Spotify, if that's your podcast platform of choice, Apple Podcasts or any of the podcast apps, you can find the NZ Tech Podcast there. And that way you'll keep up to date with our audio episodes, which tends to be most of our listenership. Of course, if you are listening and you haven't caught the video, make sure you track us down. You can follow myself on LinkedIn for the live streams. Also, you'll find NZ Tech Podcast across on YouTube, Facebook, and on X or Twitter, whichever you prefer to call it, as we're still getting used to that change. So thanks, everyone, and thanks again, Philip Whitmore, for joining the show.
Excellent. Thanks a lot.
All right, cheers.
Cheers.
The New Zealand Tech Podcast, brought to you by Guerrilla Technology, proactive and strategic IT.